Welcome to Jurisdiction, the International Intellectual Property Law Podcast for July 2013. I'm your host, Don Cameron of Breskin & Parr LLP in Toronto, Canada. We hope you'll find this podcast informative, but it should not be taken as legal advice. The opinions expressed are solely those of the participants. A common fact situation in trade secret misappropriation is to have a former employee cross the street, join a competitor, and instantly start making a copy of your product. If you're in the United States or most Western countries, you sue for trade secret misappropriation. But what do you do if your factory is in China, and so is your former key employee, who is now working across the street in China? Recently, a U.S. company was faced with just that scenario and decided to sue in China and at the International Trade Commission in the USA. What is fascinating is the decisions in both countries were issued on the same day, with very different results. Mark Wine is a partner with Orrick, Harrington & Sutcliffe LLP in their Irvine, California office and heads up their intellectual property practice there. Mark has extensive experience in litigating IP cases, including trademark, patent, and trade secrets. He has a growing experience and interest in the ability of U.S. courts to deal with matters outside the USA and the extraterritoriality of their reach in IP cases. I spoke with Mr. Wine from his office in Irvine, California. Hello, Mark.
Hello, Don. How are you?
Fine, thank you. Let's set the scene for this case. Who are the players in this dispute?
Well, there's two primary players, although there's a number of kind of ancillary players. There's SI Group, which is a company out of the Boston area and who develops rosins for use in a lot of different applications. In this case, it's for additives to rubber to make it a tacky surface that's desirable for tires and other applications. That's on one side. On the other side is a company called Sino Legend out of China that is in exactly the same business. And there's a couple of individuals that were, one in particular, Mr. Xu, who was a former employee of SI Group, who is the really the provocateur here, because he ended up transitioning his employment to Sino Legend, and therein begins the story.
So I understand we have an alleged taking of trade secrets in China, and this starts not one but three legal proceedings, two in China and one in the United States. Can you tell us about the China lawsuits?
Well, not as much is known. The transparency of that those processes is less clear, so we're getting statements about those processes, by and large, coming from the parties. But it is unusual. There was apparently a police criminal investigation that, based on the similarity of the two processes, and just so you understand, Mr. Xu left the employment of SI Group, and I think it was 2007, 2008, and almost immediately Sino Legend began producing a virtually identical substance, rosin, for use with rubber. And this was really the event that suggested to SI Group that something was going on, the virtual similarity of the identity of these two substances. They reported it to the police in China. I think it was in Guangzhou. An investigation was undertaken, but the case was dropped for a lack of evidence. We really don't know anything more about that. So civil action one was started shortly thereafter by SI Group in China, and it progressed. There's some evidence to indicate they were trying to move it along quickly, get it to trial. They came to the hearing. They didn't think they were getting the full attention of the court or the seriousness of the court. I think I read that the hearing lasted only one day, and then they, SI Group, got, in their view, disgusted or frustrated with the process and terminated civil action one in China, only to file again another time a few months later, and ultimately terminated that before it was concluded. They withdrew from that one and petitioned to have the proceeding stop, and it did not, and ultimately a decision was rendered in that second case.
And what was
meanwhile? I'm going on too long. Meanwhile, the ITC action was commenced in the United States.
Okay, staying with the Chinese proceedings for a moment, what was the outcome in the Chinese proceeding?
Well, the ultimate outcome of the second case was a finding that the two processes or the two substances, rosins, were not similar after all, and that there was no trade secret misappropriation under the applicable Chinese law. And that decision came out in a published decision, not a whole lot of detail, but simply the finding these are not the same thing, and there's no evidence of misappropriation, and there's no basis to believe that trade secrets had been misappropriated.
So turning the clock back now, there were simultaneous proceedings brought by SI Group before the International Trade Commission. What were they suing about, and why would they sue in the ITC?
Well, I have not matched all of the dates up, so I'm not 100% sure on this. My belief is they started the first Chinese proceeding to try to stop the use of the trade secret information at the root, which would have been in China, at the point and place where the manufacturing was taking place. They felt they didn't get, SI Group felt they didn't get a fair hearing. They discontinued that proceeding. And then about a year ago, in approximately, I think, the spring or early summer of 2012, they started, again, they being SI Group, feeling aggrieved, started an ITC case. And what you seek in an ITC case is not money, but an exclusion order that basically protects U.S. businesses from competing against their own technology or their own IP in the United States. So if it's a patent, which is the most frequent usage, or in this case, the trade secret, what they can argue is the trade secret that was misappropriated in China found its way into products that were going to be imported into the United States, and as a result, the ITC jurisdiction gives the right to exclude products that are the product of or contain inappropriately obtained information or infringing products. And that's what they were seeking, is to exclude Sinolegend products from coming into the United States.
And I understand from your paper that there's some precedent in the ITC for trade secret misappropriation in China, allowing you to fight in the ITC.
Yeah, my first got involved in this about 2 years ago in a case, totally different technology, as kind of an established technology as you can get, is locomotive wheels. There was a technology owned by a U.S. company that was, as is often the case also in the Sinolegend SI Group case, where in order to get manufacturing done at a good price, a U.S. company licenses some of the technology or takes it overseas, in this case China, to have the technology utilized in manufacturing. In the Tian Rui case, it was a license. The licensee basically started their own business, discontinued the license, and just started manufacturing locomotive metal wheels and then selling them into the United States. And the company who owned the trade secret that was originally licensed cried foul, went immediately to the ITC, and in a case of first impression, at least to my knowledge, the defendant, Tian Rui, said, "We really don't contest that there was trade secret misappropriation," which is unusual. And what they said was, "But it all took place in China. None of it took place in the United States. And your courts, and the ITC in particular, don't have anything to say about this. If anybody's going to have a say about it, it's the Chinese courts, and it's outside your jurisdiction." The ITC disagreed, and ultimately the Federal Circuit disagreed, and in a split opinion held that it was okay in this instance to extraterritorially apply U.S. trade secret law for the purpose of deciding if products should be excluded from entry into the United States. There was, however, and this is kind of the precursor or the foreshadowing for the second case that I wrote a piece about, Justice or Judge Kimberly Moore a great writer, former professor, said the U.S. has no business extraterritorially applying its law to Chinese conduct, and if anybody's going to have anything to say about whether this was a violation, it should be a Chinese court, suggesting that a Chinese court knows better what the laws and standards are in China, and the ITC shouldn't be fooling around. So now, go ahead.
Returning to the SI Group case, what did the ITC do with respect to Sinolegend product?
Well, it's interesting. Well, first of all, what they did was they had a hearing. It was a judge, administrative law judge Rogers, who has since this opinion was issued just a couple of months ago, has retired and joined a private law firm in the United States doing ITC work, interestingly enough. But what happened was they conducted their hearings, and the judge on schedule, actually ahead of the original schedule he'd announced, issued what's called an initial determination in public format that basically awarded a decision to the American company SI Group, and indicated that he was finding for them, and presumably some sort of exclusionary order was going to be issued. Usually, it is an order that's aimed specifically at a company. There used to be called general exclusionary orders; those are rarely granted. But so all we know is the outcome was in a very short, non-factually explicit argument where they found for the petitioner here, SI Group, and everybody then announced, on their side, announced a great victory. Later in the same day when that came out, the Chinese court announced their decision, which I've already commented on. So on the same day in two different parts of the world, the same set of facts produced two different opinions, one finding trade secret misappropriation, the other finding no trade secret misappropriation.
So what happens now to the ITC proceeding? Is there a final determination or some type of appeal route?
Well, yeah, the reason it's called an initial determination in the ITC is because ultimately it must go before it can result in any exclusion. It has to go for a final decision before the International Trade Commission, which is a group of individuals appointed, usually a large number of them are long-term government service people, but there's also a few political appointees, and that commission takes up the issue, basically looks at the record and issues a decision based on the record. More often than not, it affirms what the administrative law judge has found, because the administrative law judge held the hearing himself or herself, but on occasion they reverse or modify the opinion. What'll be interesting to see here is what effect, if any, the intervening or the simultaneous decision of the Chinese court has on the actions of the ITC. My personal guess is it will have no impact and may or may not even get mentioned. They will simply say, based on the evidence produced at the hearing, and we're going to support what the ALJ said and find that this constitutes a violation and issue an exclusion order. I think it'll be more interesting when it gets then to the appeal from that decision. The appeal is to the Federal Circuit Court of Appeals, and that one is going to be quite interesting because you've got Judge Moore, who said in the Tian Rui case, we shouldn't be messing around in fully Chinese conduct, and the Chinese should have their own right to determine things under their law. Lo and behold, case comes up on SI Group versus Sinolegend, and we have a Chinese decision that says we find that our law has not been violated by this conduct, yet the ITC, again messing around in foreign affairs, has found that it does violate the level of conduct that is being presumed for purposes of what goes on in China. So it sets up kind of an interesting battle over how far can we extraterritorially apply our moral judgments and laws on conduct outside our boundaries.
Do you know if in the ITC proceeding itself there was any discussion of what the Chinese law was, or were the trade secret issues determined under U.S. law?
Well, it's interesting. The original determination, as I understand it, was to try to, well, if you go back again to Tian Rui, just to give an example, in Tian Rui, what they tried to do is they tried to apply, because trade secret law is essentially state law, it's not federal law, and they applied the law of Illinois, which was, I think, the site of the petitioner who had licensed the trade secret. The ITC and then the Federal Circuit said, that doesn't really make any sense. There's nothing Illinois-related in this. But they found that, that essentially they applied what they referred to, I think, as the federal common law of trade secrets, and they did that because they felt there was a, there's enough similarity in trade secret law with the universal trade there's a universal act that applies that most states have adopted. So they applied what they called a common law of trade secrets in the U.S. My understanding is they made some rough attempt to compare that to what they believed would have happened in China and said it was not inconsistent. Because we haven't seen the full detail yet, what happens in the ITC and has happened in the SI case is there's a, the public and the non-public versions of opinions. So one assumes that there was a supporting opinion from Judge Rogers that is that was not made public yet, and in that is probably the discussion of the law. I don't know, and I've not been able to get any of the lawyers to comment on what attempt was made to discern the Chinese law, but based on what happened in Tian Rui, I think it was given very little attention.
Interesting. It'll be interesting to see where this goes.
Yeah. I think it will. I mean, it's the next iteration of the Tian Rui route, and it's engendered a lot of discussion about the extraterritorial application of U.S. law at a time when the U.S. is very concerned about the activities of Chinese companies and/or the Chinese government sponsoring Chinese companies to systematically, prolong technology from the United States. The Obama administration has been very outspoken about those issues in recent months. There's been a lot of talk about beefing up trade secret laws and so forth. And not coincidentally, there's a fair amount of activity. Since I wrote the article that you're referring to, another case has come down drawing attention to a slightly different aspect of this same problem, where in a Wisconsin court issued a criminal indictment against a Chinese company by the name of Sinovel in the wind turbine area, where they claim they were complicit in organizing the download of software to enable them to compete with a U.S. company in the development of wind turbines. And now the big issue is, can the U.S. criminal law, can this summons even be served on a Chinese company which has no presence in the United States? And that's a separate dispute that's ongoing about what the limits are of U.S. law and legal systems applicability to cybercrime, if you will.
Thank you very much for these insights, Mark.
Well, it's been my pleasure. This is a topic that is both timely and interesting, so I think my advice to everybody is stay tuned, because I think there's going to be a lot of developments in this area and a lot of interesting jurisprudence over the next months.
Mark Wine is a partner with Orrick, Harrington, and Sutcliffe LLP in Irvine, California. Orrick has a publication that they put out every 3 months called The World in U.S. Courts, Orrick's quarterly review of decisions applying U.S. law to global business and cross-border activities. It assembles in one place descriptions and summaries of recent U.S. judicial decisions discussing when U.S. courts and agencies will take jurisdiction over disputes arising out of conduct occurring outside the United States. Orrick also has a trade secrets watch law blog. For links to the quarterly report, the Trade Secrets blog, and for further information on Mr. Wine and the Oreck Law Firm, please visit iplawpodcast.com. You have been listening to Jurisdiction, the International Intellectual Property Law Podcast. I'm Don Cameron of Breskin & Parr LLP in Toronto, Canada. Thank you for listening.